start. So for this informal, so we had already, we had the very formal conference where Rob gave his spectacular talk. And then today we have, you know, a sort of much less formal workshop. Tomorrow's the really interesting informal workshop. So nothing's planned at this stage. It's tomorrow from 9:30 until we solve all the problems of quantum foundations, or 1 p.m., whichever happens first. And it's in this room. Can you email me by 11 p.m. tonight if you want to give a short presentation? And I thought, actually, to make it more interesting, or if you want somebody else to give a short presentation. And you should say who that person is. Also spread the word, everyone is welcome. So if there's someone who's not in the room right now who you think might want to come, let them know and nominate them to give a short presentation. Okay. Let's get some stock. So continuing the spirit of informality, this is going to be a very informal talk because I didn't really get time to prepare it. So I thought I'd start with a sort of general feeling I have, which is that I think that ultimately quantum theory will be wrong. This is motivated. Yesterday I was chatting to someone at dinner who had the opposite belief. They thought, well, quantum theory would always be correct, and it seems to me inconceivable that any physical theory will be correct into the indefinite future. On the other hand, I think I'd done to make a stronger statement than that. I think that quantum theory will turn out to be incorrect. We'll find a better theory in our lifetime. And here's the particular reason I think that quantum theory is going to be wrong. And it has to do with quantum gravity. So in general relativity, the metric is dynamical. You solve the equations for the metric. So in particular, that means that causal structure is dynamical. So whether two events are separated by a space-like or a time-like interval, whether it's possible to send a signal between two events, will be itself dynamical. Now, in quantum theory, all dynamical quantities are subject to superposition. Superposition, if you want to, rather than giving it a mathematical name, giving it a sort of more philosophical kind of name, is no matter of the factness. No, it's more than that, because in quantum theory, there seems to be some sense in which there's no matter of the fact as to whether the particle goes through, you know, one slit or the other slit. And the reason I prefer this rather than the term superposition is because if quantum theory is wrong, then the mathematical structure of quantum theory might not survive. However, it's likely that this kind of no matter of the factness will survive. That doesn't have to be the case, of course, but it's possible, it's likely, it seems to me. So the problem we have now is if we apply this second statement to this first, then it looks like you'll have something like a superposition of different metrics, or a superposition or no matter of factness of different causal structures. So imagine trying to foliate this situation into space-like hypersurfaces. Well, that means in particular that the interval between here and here is space-like. However, it looks like from here that we have to admit that there's going to be no matter of the factness as to whether a particular interval is space-like or time-like. So it looks like we can't foliate our space, and so we can't evolve a wave function in time. So Penrose gives an argument that's similar to this, and he uses it to motivate a certain experiment where you put a mass into a superposition of different places. Okay, so if you buy this argument, or even if you think that quantum theory will turn out to be wrong eventually, the question is, well, what are we going to do? Which direction do we take it in? How do we even understand what it means to try and modify quantum theory if it turns out to be incorrect? So one idea might be, well, you could look at the Schrodinger equation for the wave function psi and try modifying that equation. Well, if you have a deterministic modification of the Schrodinger equation by adding nonlinear terms, it turns out, so Weinberg suggested something like that, it turns out that you get superluminal signaling as proven by Gizan. So it seems like that's a bad direction to go in. But in a sense, it's even worse than that, because here you're only talking about modifying quantum theory in its own terms, on its own terms. The wave function is a mathematical object that belongs to the formulation of quantum theory. Modifications of quantum theory that still use this wave function are in some sense not very radical, or perhaps overly conservative, let's say, because and so that seems like the wrong starting point to me. Incidentally, Penrose used this kind of argument I gave, a more sophisticated version of it, to motivate a modification of the Schrodinger equation where you get stochastic collapse. But it seems to me that that's not a sufficiently radical modification of quantum theory, because you're still attempting to have this picture of a wave function evolving in time. It seems to me like that's not the right way to think. Okay, so I think a better way to proceed is to work in the framework of generalized probability theories. So let me talk about what they are. So the early versions of these kinds of approaches were very conservative with respect to time, which is something I want to get away from, but let's look at how they work. So the idea is, well, you have some box similar to what Matt showed you. You have a preparation, you have a transformation, and you have a measurement. I like time to go up because I'm an optimist. And now, after this first box, you've got a system which is prepared in some state. And I want to represent the state by a list of probabilities. Probabilities corresponding to different measurements and specified outcomes that you might perform on this preparation box. So here's an example. So in quantum theory, you represent a state by a density matrix. Imagine you have a spin half particle. In which case you'd represent the state like this. And it turns out that this object is equivalent to, or has the same information as this object. And actually, more than just having the same information, there's a linear map between these two objects. Okay. So here's an example of representing a state by a list of probabilities. Notice that rather than using the wave function, which I argued was a bad place to start, we're using the density matrix, and then we're mapping that into this object, a list of probabilities. And this object has meaning in a general sense, away from quantum theory. This is a much more general way of thinking about states.
Minus?
No, it should be y plus. So you can show that if you know these four probabilities, you can determine the numbers inside here. It's just a piece of mathematics. Yeah. You need z plus and z minus for to get the normalization, but the other numbers you need to get the phase, if you like. Okay. And just to push this analogy a bit more, in quantum theory, the probability is given by the trace of the projector or the positive operator associated with the given measurement outcome that you perform on a preparation times the density matrix associated with the preparation. And if you want instead to represent your state as a list of probabilities like this, then you can write the same formula as the dot product of the state and another vector associated with your measurement outcome. Okay, and this can all be pushed further. If you want to look at what happens when you evolve a state through a box, you can show that it's just mapped in a linear way. So this is a matrix of real numbers that acts on this column vector.
Just linear map. It's linear. It's a fine map. It's linear map plus.
No, this is linear because I'm keeping in the both degrees of freedom required for normalization.
You're paying here.
Yeah, but I'm not paying well. So this is one of my bugbears. I think that people, I think I've got it called premature normalization. There's no reason to normalize states, and actually you end up throwing out useful information if you normalize states. It's a bad habit that people have in quantum theory. But I don't have time to explain why I feel that way. It's true. I mean, it's really only in a sort of naive causal situation where you're evolving a state forward in time that you can get away with normalizing, because then it doesn't depend. There's a long debate there. Okay. So now we have states that presumably belong to some set of allowed states. We have these vectors associated with measurements that belong to some set of allowed vectors for that. And then we have matrices, associated transformations that belong to some set of allowed transformations. And now it seems like we're in a much better situation, much better position, if we want to consider modifying the theory, because we can consider modifying these sets. Of course, it isn't completely trivial. We have to be careful modifying these sets because we want to be sure that whenever we do a calculation of the probability associated with something like this, we still get a number between 0 and 1. But we are in a much better position now. Okay. But like I said, like I said, this is still very conservative with regard to time. We can go a bit further. Let's go here. We can introduce composite system structure. So we can imagine that we have something like this. So now we haven't just got one system going up, but we've got a bunch of systems. Let me put a box in here just to. And this is still very conservative with regard to time, because you have this foliation as you go up. We can be a bit less conservative in the next picture, although still this won't be enough. So we can imagine sort of relaxing the idea that this thing, this graph, the position of these boxes in this graph is important, or in this circuit diagram. So we can actually just interpret something like this as a graph. When you have a graph, it doesn't really matter where the boxes and wires are, as long as they have the same connections. So we could draw something like this. For example, okay, and we can allow ourselves to move these boxes around in any way we want. We can have much more complicated graphs than this. And now, so in this picture, we were thinking as if there was a foliation into time. Now we don't really have that. We could foliate it, but that seems to be adding extra structure that isn't actually there in the graph. The graph doesn't have any foliation because you could move this box. So this one, for example, so then these two would have the opposite direction, but it's the same graph, the opposite causal order. And of course, in a more complicated graph like this, you could make all sorts of maneuvers, all sorts of moves that would change the graph in terms of the vertical positions of the boxes, but it will still be the same graph. So it'd be nice to proceed in a way that doesn't need this background foliation. Actually, this connects with the stuff that Sandhu was talking about in his talk, and I think a lot of the same mathematics is behind this. I think you said that your thing, you didn't have to put a foliation across. Yeah. So this is the same point. So let's take a. Oh, actually, I think I want to keep. No, I'm in danger of running into the picture over there. So let me draw this picture again. Let's take a very simple circuit like this. So now what I've done is I've got these boxes, and this labeled by big uppercase letters A, B, and C, and then I've got the lowercase letters which label the system types passing between the boxes, and this graph here. You can denote it in a symbolic way, like this. This isn't quite right yet. So each of these symbols has the outputs, because time is going up, remember, on the top of the box and the inputs on the bottom of the box. Superscripts correspond to outputs and subscripts correspond to inputs. And now we have to add a little bit extra information because we need to say which because A is here twice, because we have, say, two electrons. So we need to add a bit more information. Oh, there's a mistake here. This should be an A. A. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So now we have a symbolic representation of the same graphic information that's in the in this diagram. Okay. So each of these boxes is sort of, you know, some experimental thing, and it may have a light on it which can flash, or a meter which can give a particular reading. And in particular, for each of these boxes, we're interested in a particular light flashing. So that's taken to be specified as part or implicit in the symbol A here. Here, maybe we're interested in if the green light flashes. Over here, the blue light, and over here, the yellow light. Okay. So that's taken to be implicit in this notation. So these are not just boxes, but also boxes with events specified. And we can ask, what's the probability that we see the given set of lights flashing as I specified? Well, if you make a certain assumption called tomographic locality, which I won't go into, which is true in quantum theory and also in classical probability theory, then you can show, I've used my space for here. You can show that this is equal to, I'm using different colored chalk, I'll explain why. Maybe I should use radically different colored chalk. Okay, I'll explain why in a moment. You can show that the probability associated with this circuit and the given lights flashing is given by a mathematical expression that looks like this, where these are now tensors. So it's important that over here we have description, operational description. This is sort of a schematic diagram of what the experiment looks like. And over here we have mathematical objects. Tensors. We can also do the same thing. We can represent instead this mathematical calculation here using Penrose diagrammatic notation. This here has the same meaning as that, for those of you who are familiar with Penrose's diagrammatic notation. Okay, so what's interesting about this is that it's a bit less conservative with regard to causal structure, because now we're not using any foliation of this circuit. When we do this calculation, this calculation here has exactly the same structure as the description of the circuit. We're not using the any foliation in here at all. So it's a bit less conservative. It has the same kind of feature that Sandhu mentioned with regard to the multi-time framework. Actually, these are just sets of numbers that are related linearly to probabilities, the objects inside these tensors. There's also a quantum version of this where you relate these numbers linearly to certain operators. When you do that, you get, in some sense, something which is very similar to what Sandhu was talking about. It's kind of a sort of mixed state generalization of the of the multi-time formulation that Sandhu talked about. And in fact, when I proved a crucial theorem in this approach, I used the notation that you talked about earlier. Okay. But we still have here definite causal structure. This particle is flowing from here to here, if you like, along a time-like hypersurface. We're distinguishing inputs from outputs. The causal structure is still there, and it's still definite. It's still a part of the picture. So we haven't really worked out how to address the kind of issue I was talking about here. So my first response to this was to develop something I called the causaloid approach. There's a paper on that from, well, the first one was in 2005. But more recently, I've been thinking beyond that approach. And there's something very interesting happening here. If you look at these pictures, well, I pointed it out already. What's interesting is that the calculation, the mathematical calculation you do, has exactly the same compositional structure as the object that it's a calculation for. Seems very strange that you have an object, you want to do a calculation for some properties of that object, and the calculation has exactly the same structure as the object itself. So this motivated me to think in this way. Well, first of all, you have you have the operational description of some situation. So over here, we have this operational description, a bunch of boxes with wires connected them. And then we want to put some theory on top of this. So for example, we might want to calculate probabilities pertaining to this situation. Or we might want to calculate something else. So this is the operational, this is the theory that goes on top of this operational description. And furthermore, it's this calculation over here inherits its structure from the compositional form of this operational description. So here's a sort of an example of what you might think about here. Imagine we have this two-dimensional table. Okay. So here's a leg, there's the top. We can represent this table more schematically. By this kind of diagram. So this is just a schematic representation of this table. And then we might want to calculate certain properties of the table. So one example might be to calculate the height of the table. Well, the height would correspond to some number coming from here, the length of this leg, plus the thickness of this top. So it would be nice if we could show that these kinds of calculations, the sort of full set of calculations we're interested in for tables, and maybe we may go to more general furniture, we allow ourselves to have more objects, that the kinds of calculations, like the dimensions of these things, can be calculated by in terms of a calculation that has the same structural form as the object itself. That would be nice. And this over here is one worked out example of that type. I have another worked out example in the paper on this stuff. Okay. So if we have a good operational description of the kind of thing we're trying to make predictions about, and then if we think that we can make the composition principle work, then this is a very this is a potentially a way of constructing physical theories. And it should work even if we don't have definite causal structure, as long as we have a good operational description. So that's the idea. Where is my, what's the sort of timing situation? Okay, so. I'm just wondering if I have time for the next. Well, I'll just draw the next diagram and then I'll stop there. Okay. So obviously, what we're trying to do here is come up with a theory of quantum gravity, in case I didn't advertise that fact, and we're not there yet. But here's the general approach. We have classical probability theory and quantum theory. Both of these theories fit very well into the sort of the general probability theory structure I described to you. Over here, we have a theory, I'm going to call it probabilistic general relativity. The idea is that you try to put general relativity into an operational framework and add probabilities. Turns out that's actually not straightforward, but I have a project to develop this approach, and you can watch the talks on PERSA I gave on that recently. Then over here is the holy grail, quantum gravity. And that's the thing we're trying to get to. Now, as you go from this side over here to this side, you end up going from having definite causal structure, fixed causal structure even, to, let me call it fuzzy causal structure. So this could just be sort of probabilistic in a classical sense, that you have sort of classical combinations of different causal structures, or it could be indefinite causal structure in some sort of quantum gravity sense, that you have actual no matter the factness as to what the underlying causal structure is. And then up here, we're going from the classical to the quantum world. And so we have... We want some notion of quantization. And the hope is that if one can identify this framework and then apply an appropriate notion of quantization to this, then you'll get to some kind of theory of quantum gravity. Or maybe the other way around. You go to quantum theory, then apply something that takes you from fixed to fuzzy causal structure. I was calling that GRization. But I think Penrose had the same idea, and he called it gravitization, I think. Okay, so. Well, I have some ideas about how to go from here to here, but I won't talk about those because I don't want to run over time. But you got some idea of the kind of way I was thinking of going from here to here, and the idea is to is to go via this path to get a good operational description of the kind of theory you want, and then work out how to put probabilities on top of it. This is what you'd have to do, for example, to develop a theory of probabilistic general relativity. It's very difficult in general relativity because it's not clear what the observables are, what are the things you might see. General relativity is notoriously difficult in that respect. Okay, well, let me just conclude by saying I think that generalized probability theories, and actually what I might call generalized general probability theories, because we want to add this extra structure, are a really good place for an attack on these deep fundamental problems in physics. Thanks. Okay, well, I don't want to close. I think Rob was first, then Sandra, then Joe.
I just want to play devil's advocate about what you said originally about no matter of the fact concerning quantum structure.
Yeah.
Isn't that contingent on assuming that quantum states are not states of knowledge? Because if quantum states are states of knowledge,
right,
superposition of quantum states is just another state of knowledge.
Right. Yeah.
Doesn't mean it has to be anything fuzzy or indefinite.
Yeah, sure. So I think maybe a more neutral way to put it is I forgot to invoke this image, that in classical probability theory, you have this probability simplexes. And then in quantum theory, it's sort of like the you get these bulges because it gets curved. And so quantum theory is like classical probability theory on steroids. And we need to work out how to inject the steroids here. I don't really care, to be honest, about the interpretational questions. If we can get to this corner of the graph, I'm happy even if we don't solve the interpretational questions. But mathematically, I think that something like this is going to survive. Now, how you interpret what you have here in this corner is another question. But mathematically, if one can find the right way to go from here to here, then that's kind of and correspondingly to go from here to here, then that's kind of enough, at least initially.
I thought you said that your grounds that quantum theory would have to be overthrown. You said it was inconceivable that quantum theory could continue to hold in the future. Mm-hmm. And the grounds for that inconceivability was
right. Okay,
fair enough. Causal structure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's put this. Sure. That's a good point. Definitely, it's inconceivable to me that. When you have a theory of quantum gravity, that it will. So first of all, I think it has to be a probabilistic theory. First, and secondly, I think that the probability spaces associated with that will not be simple classical simplexes. Okay, that also seems inconceivable to me. So then, I think everything I said before goes through. That if I sort of slightly modify, take away the philosophy, just keep the mathematical statement there, then I think we then have a problem with causal structure, still, because we don't know how to deal with that. In quantum theory.
You just said to suggest inconsistency with quantum theory. That's what I'm missing. Say I do all this and I get a...
Well, no, but in standard quantum theory, you evolve a state in time. You need a foliation. But we know we know that mathematically we won't be able to treat... Well, first of all, we won't have a foliation because we have to have at least probabilities over different causal structures. And furthermore, the space... The kind of space that those probabilities live in won't be classical simplexes, so we can't appeal to just taking a mixture of a classical theories. It won't just be like this. It'll be more radical. So then we're in a difficult mathematical territory. But it may be, of course, that there is ultimately some ontological picture in the background that doesn't have probabilities or is in some way classical. I don't know. Yeah.
Quantum theory with its sort of preferred foliation the way we normally formulate it.
Yeah.
They're not conceivably described.
Yeah. That's my feeling. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Thanks.
So Sandu then Joe.
So look, the 4 points definitely beautiful, and most probably this is what will be. On the other hand, there are good reasons why quantum mechanics is not formulated like this, because I presume to put Schrödinger equation into this will be far more tricky than to put it at the level of wave functions.
Right.
To do it at the level of probabilities.
Yeah.
So maybe that will get really, really very difficult mathematical problems.
That would get difficult.
Yes, to try to formulate everything in terms of probabilities.
Right.
Because even to do quantum mechanics just in terms of probabilities, it's a tough.
I mean, in the end, I think it looks quite simple. I mean, what one test this kind of framework fails, at least I haven't shown that it passes yet, is so one of the Aronov's points is, does it make some calculations simpler?
Yeah,
I haven't shown that it makes any calculations simpler yet. And I would never choose to do an ordinary calculation in this framework. I would just resort to the normal.
Is it possible? But not necessarily easy, but can you somehow solve some simple standard problem and get the same result quantum mechanics?
I mean,
or in some regime?
You mean with this framework?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you would always get the same. As long as this is for finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, so you'd always get the same answers. For sure, it's exactly equivalent to the theory of finite dimensional Hilbert spaces with super operators and CP maps and P of EMs, all that kind of stuff. It's the same thing. I should say a similar framework has been developed by the Pavia crowd, Giulio and Paolo and Mara. They call it the quantum combs framework.
So I was just wondering about your opinions about fuzzy, how to introduce fuzzy causal structure and how they've evolved since you were doing the causaloid stuff. So that, I mean, in between that period, there's people that this work by Oreshkov and Zuck.
Right.
That. So
yeah.
The thing I was wondering about particularly was this clash between bringing in this indefinite causal structure, no matter what the fact causal structure on the one hand, and then sticking with some of the operational. Sort of assuming that you've still got a nice place to do the to talk about operational quantum physics on the other. So in their framework, they talk about people being able to do normal lab stuff,
right?
But
yeah.
Then two labs saying having indefinite causal structure. So it seems like there might be a clash between those two things. It's difficult for me to imagine that an experiment like that. I had the same kind of worry about causaloids. So you didn't say too much today about how you're going to introduce quasi causal structure now. So can you comment on how you're going to do that, in particular with regards to that issue? It's a bit of a vague question.
Yeah, but it's the pertinent vague questions. So I think this corner is the key, because it turns out to be quite difficult to do this kind of thing, to general relativity, to introduce probabilities. And also I want to introduce agency as well, the idea of knob settings, which is kind of a feature of these operational frameworks. That's not the way people normally think about general relativity. And the approach I'm taking uses ideas that were developed by Hans Westman and Sebastianus Sonego. So I think if you take their approach, you can start to, abuse their approach, because they had different ideas for this approach, but you can extract an operational description of experiments. So this is the key thing. If you can extract an operational description of the sort of domain of physics that you're trying to look at, then you're in a good position. And then you just have to put probabilities into the picture. And that's difficult because you don't have a background time. You can't just have some initial distribution over some stuff and then evolve it forward in time like you would normally do probability. So instead, this compositional approach of looking at little parts of the world described operationally and seeing how they fit together is the key thing.
It sounds a little bit more subtle than having sort of labs where everything's normal floating around in a world of indefinite causal structure.
Yeah, I think it's, you really want to have, you have more than that. You have the actual things being tied together by some physics, that why is this lab? In some sense, close to this other lab, you know, or whatever this regional space, and that's the issue. Yeah.
I just want to mention that, you see, if you really want to put definite causal structure in quantum mechanics, that's pretty trivial to do, because you may have some two events, you know, which their ordering depends, you introduce an ancilla, it depends on that ancilla. And in fact, you can superpose this thing with a well-defined phase, not just mixture of them, because you measure that ancilla in a different basis. Right. It's pretty simple to do that. And that would be sort of equivalent of not describing the geometry with intrinsic things, right, but with a big embedding.
Yeah,
which is
that
might be simpler.
Rob has talked about this kind of thing as well. But my worry is that in the end, you've always got, in that kind of situation, you've always got in the end actually a sort of background description with a definite causal structure. And I think that, it might give you clues as to what sort of mathematical objects you have. But I think in the end, if your thing is embeddable in some nice regular background structure, probably you've gone the wrong way. So I think that what you're saying may be a good place to get clues as to the shape of these funny objects, you know, as you go from here to here. But still, it's a hard job.
Description of curvature by embedding it.
Yeah.
But at least to know what you're doing.
So you're chairing, but we, okay, Rob.
I want to ask about your compositional principle. I don't know what Bob Kuka says about it, but I'm guessing a category theorist would look at that and say, you're assuming that, you know, on the one hand, you have a category of different types of objects, different types of physical operations you can do those objects, sequential compositions of those operations, parallel, and you're asking for a functor onto a category of tensors where all those notions of compositions are represented by certain mathematical operations.
Right.
And so that's, you would characterize it that way as well. And so if I think about it that way, is it
so
an example of a more general principle? Like, when should I expect a functor to mathematical objects?
So, so suddenly I was motivated to draw these kinds of pictures by the work that Bob and his, that was absolutely the motivation. And I think the other group as well, the quantum combs people were also motivated by those diagrams. However, there seems to be a sort of schizophrenic attitude in the category community. When they draw a picture, they seem to have the proper graphical intuitions. But when they write down symbolic notation, they insert all these funny symbols that look like this, and they insist on doing things in the right way. And what I did here was not like this. Look, this and this have the same structure. So I think that these things are going to be equivalent to category theoretic problems. But I think there's a lot of value in trying to find symbolic notation and intuitions that really don't rely on these misplaced notions of tensor product and composition.
You have a notion of parallel and sequential composition, except you're representing it differently.
Well, there are
indexes.
Well, what you could say is over here, the freedom you have is which order to calculate with these integers. So I can choose any permutation of these integers and do the calculation in that order. Over here, this mathematical calculation. Now over here, on the other hand, the intuition is that you have a foliation basically, and you have steps, and you compose and you tensor product according to that foliation. So then you're restricting yourself to a subset of the ways of calculating this from here. Now you can, within the category framework, give yourself extra tools like cups and caps that are running around, and then you can manipulate any calculation given in these terms in the category theoretic way into any of these permutations. Okay, but that's a hell of a lot of work to do for nothing when you can just write this down straight away in a sort of manifestly covariant framework, if you like. So assuming our FQXI project is successful, I'll be working with with those guys exactly on this issue of trying to get some interplay between these two different ways of thinking. But I think that these are misplaced notions, and the.
Axioms about parallel and sequential composition that say things like in diagrammatic language, if I have two boxes on separate wires that are like this, I can do that, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
And
right.
That ends up being the equation that involves tensors and compositions
okay.
And basically.
And you can manipulate it.
Yeah.
Whereas here, well, you don't even need to do that, you've just
right.
Got it. It's manifestly invariant.
Right. And Bob says the same thing. He said why you know express it in terms of these ugly tensor products
right.
When
yeah.
You express it in terms of the simple diagram and then
yeah.
You know that axiom is implicit. But
yeah.
I wonder if that, while that's true for, you know, working, you know, it may also be useful to know that, you know, my two notions of composition
mm-hmm.
satisfy such and such an axiom, you know, because that tells me something about the structure I'm dealing with. So, you know, not seeing the tensor and the composition anywhere and not having these equalities that tell you that you can, you know, regroup the terms of UI, you might lose something. You might understand less of what's
going on. I guess my bet is that you don't. My bet is that because this mathematics is right. It's completely is isomorphic to the actual physical situation. That this is the right way to go, and that when you insert, basically you're inserting a foliation if you talk like that. If you do this stuff, you're inserting a foliation, and then you're inserting something which isn't physical into the picture. And so I think it's just it's the wrong way to go. But you know, look, I'm not a category theorist, and it's sort of a vast subject which I essentially don't understand at all. So
maybe this gives you what I'm describing gives you a way of saying precisely what it is that doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might be hard pressed to say in what ways you can change this circuit and still have the same thing. And like if I wanted to express what foliation independence was,
mm-hmm.
I would obviously have to have a formalism wherein I could talk about foliations.
Right.
But you know, maybe the point is that you want to take away the latter eventually.
But you can talk about foliations here, and you can see that it's independent of them. They're just not in this calculation. I think that's the point. I mean, you can see what they are. You can this circuit isn't a very good example because it only has one foliation. But a richer circuit would have many alternative foliations. But you don't need those foliations as part of the calculation. And it seems to me strange because category theory is extremely mathematical, but it seems to me that this idea of needing a foliation is driven almost by a physical intuition that you have to evolve a state in time. And that's, we know from relativity, especially general relativity, that we need to get away from that notion that we shouldn't think in those terms. Okay.
Given the time, I think we should at least give people who need to get out of here an opportunity to do so. If other people want to stick around and continue the discussion, that's fine. But let's thank Lucian again.